Dr. Grant, when I was teaching at the university, I always detested 1 o'clock classes. Because at least 3/4 of the class, I found it as a good nap time. And I hope maybe you don't feel inclined in that direction. But after all of that food we've been consuming. I see I still have my clock, so I have an hour and 35 minutes to go. Governance is an artifact of culture. We're going to look at the interplay between culture and governance forms. As Tim reminded me this morning, I told you you're going to lose your job. This afternoon, I'm going to tell you how you're going to keep it. So they told Tim. The big problem I find in sharing culture change and governance with boards and faculties is there's a confusion between authority and governance. So let's quickly define what we mean by authority. Authority is simply mandatory power. There is some form of power to decision making that's imposed by either a legal or a constituent documentation. We call them bylaws. A good point to start understanding institutional culture is to study your bylaws. When I go to a seminary, that's the first thing I ask for, can I see your bylaws? And I can tell you pretty much how your governance system is. So the bylaws is your mandated power. And if the faculty are not listed in the bylaws, you have no faculty power. And that's often the case. That's a very common observation in seminary governance. So authority is mandatory power. There have been those that have defined governance as the stewardship of power. That is the use, the management of authority. But if your authority is not mandated, you have nothing to use. So the first place you have to start is to see if the faculty are empowered in the institutional bylaws. There are three forms of authority, and it's important in evaluating your own institutional authority. And one of the problems I have here is I'm going to have to talk generally and theoretically, while each of you are particular and specific. You have an institutional governance system. How many of you are freestanding? Let me see your hands. Freestanding. That's about right in the ratio, because freestanding seminaries have no constituency. And that's why they are fewer in number. They have only publics. And I'll come back to that dichotomy. How many denominational seminaries do we have? Should have a few more, and we do. How many embedded seminaries do we have? That's the growing number. We're at 41% in the association. We will be at 50%, probably within 5 years. Embedded seminaries reflect a measure of survival. It's Plan B, and so you'll see quite a few seminaries becoming embedded. How many divinity schools do we have? One. That's two. That's about right. That gives me a little idea of the spread, the mosaic of governance types represented. And each one of those types will have varieties of governance systems within them. Denominational seminaries may have a direct connection, governance-wise, between the institution and the constituent body. There may be a denominational body running the board of trustees of the seminary. And so you get into those kinds of intricate governance systems. But they're all typical of the industrial age, where you have bureaucratic authority on the vertical line. And so that has a great impact on how decisions are made in a denominational seminary. The preference is to be a freestanding seminary, because as a faculty and a board, you have maximum liberty to make your decisions without accountability to a constituent. But you have huge responsibility to stakeholders that are public. And so there's a different governance pattern in the freestanding institution. Within the authority matrix, we have three categories of authority. You can see in my diagram, I've already made it horizontal rather than vertical. And so I see the board and the president and the faculty as the three authority structures in the new form of institutional governance, working horizontally. And so that's what that diagram is intended to portray. The yellow is to imply a constituency if you're a denomination. On the other hand, a freestanding seminary does have a little constituency. The board and the faculty are its constituents. That was a hard lesson I had to learn in going to Gordon Conwell, that we only had 66 members of our constituency. And that really impacts fundraising. Because I learned in a freestanding seminary, you earn money or you secure money on the basis of success and not on the basis of need. If you have a constituency, you can go to them that we need to pay the sewer bill, and they will help you. But try that in a freestanding seminary. You have no constituency, and the faculty and the board really are not concerned about your sewer bill. So it shifts. So it's important that we define our constituencies. But in that context, our structures do have mandated power. The board has final authority that's imposed upon them legally and ethically. In other words, 501c3, the internal revenue, requires the seminary to have a board that is the final authority. Ethically, they are the ones responsible to stand behind to deliver what they say they will deliver. So they have final authority in the decision-making process. The president has delegated authority. He has delegated authority. He has maximum, or she has maximum responsibility with no ability to finalize that responsibility. They have only delegated authority. They are the facilitators of the governance process. So they have delegated authority, and that is spelled out in the bylaws. The faculty have functional authority. That is, whatever the bylaws say as to what the faculty will be doing, that is their authority. Normally, they have the responsibility for participating in the selection of faculty, in establishing the admission requirements, in designing the curriculum and the educational programming, and declaring the graduation standards or requirements, and declaring students fulfill them. That's the normal functional authority of the faculty. The president nor the board has no authority to do those functions. Nor does the faculty have final authority. It is the faculty that fulfill the educational mission of the institution. And it is the board and the management or president that fulfill its operational and management requirements. This historically is known as the duality of control. The duality of control. That was first established in 1915. If you go back to my map of this morning, that's an important date because for the 50 years before that, faculties were cut out of the governance work of the institutions. Presidents and boards were doing it. They eventually added administrators, and the faculty were cut out. So in 1915, AAUP was formed, and as a result, shared governance became a responsibility of the faculty. So this year we celebrate 100 years of shared governance within the higher educational tradition. It was embellished in 1966 to spell out clearly what the faculty's role was in the governance process, and that's pretty much as I have described in terms of functional authority. In terms of American culture, we have three forms of government that we deal with. We have public government, which is really civil government. We have that at the public school level, as well as at the national level, where citizens, through an elected political process, and some would call it political governance, have a right to achieve public governance leadership roles. So we have a public governance system. We also have a policy governance. How many of you follow the Carter system? You got one? Great, wonderful. Because policy governance just doesn't work in higher education. And yet you hear people talking about the Carver model. It's a top-down, where the board establishes policy and the faculty implement it. And that's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is participatory governance, shared governance. If you have a small institution, 10 faculty members or less, it's probably what we call collegial governance. I've done a few seminars for such schools, and I find out that on every Wednesday, the faculty bring a brown bag and they have lunch. But that's the school governance session. It's called collegial governance. And so there are the three forms of governance in American culture. And what we're really speaking to is participatory governance or shared governance. So what we look at, board with the final authority, governance system being facilitated by the president with delegated authority, and a faculty with functional authority for the educational program. You say, what about the administration? Well, Tim accuses me of getting rid of the administration. Don't they have any authority? They have only the authority that the president will grant to them out of their delegated authority. They have, in and of themselves, no authority. And you'll see a little bit later on some of the trends that are coming in. We are getting rid of the CFO. Are there any here? I hope not. Simply because in the CFO's office, they have taken unto themselves an authority for the spending of money within the institution. Whoever has that authority controls the mission of the institution, and that responsibility belongs to the president. And so we are shifting the CFO into the office of the president and out of the administration. Well, that may be getting too deep for you. And that, it's important, I think, that we realize in the Yelp circle, if we're freestanding, that really stands for the public. What are our responsibilities to our stakeholders? Have you defined your stakeholders? Or are you assuming that? Do you give your stakeholders any role in the governance process? Or are they truly just your publics? At Gordon Conwell, we have 57 publics. Did you know that, Rick? I'll show you the diagram. We spent a year studying that. We have 57 publics that we can build relationships with. Well, you're beginning to get the idea that authority and authority structures, until you define your authority and you declare the boundaries of your authority structure, you cannot define a governance system or a governance process. Governance processing depends upon clearly, formally defined authority structures. Okay, Greg, I'd like to go to that next one.
I know, not that one, the other one. Yep, I know, I'm getting there.
Okay, thanks. Now I want to begin to shift that understanding from authority into the governance question. So what is governance? The simplest definition would be the decision-making system of the institution. But let me give you one that's a little more meaningful. It is the unique process that an institution designs to build and to maintain the decision-making process that balances the legitimate interests of the authority structures toward the fulfillment of mission with economic sustainability. Tear it apart. Governance is a unique process. In other words, there is no one right way. That's why I can't stand up here and say, this is the way you must go. Every institution has to design their own governance system because every institution is unique. It has its own history, its own set of core values, its own culture. And it's in the light of those factors, unique as they are, that you will design your governance system. In fact, your theological understanding of authority will influence how you design authority structures. I learned that real fast when I was doing governance seminars for the Roman Catholic Diocese in Chicago. I discovered real fast they only have one trustee, and he's called the Archbishop. There's no question about where final authority is in that system, and those seminaries had to work with that. Unique process that you have to design, you have to build, and they must be maintained. As culture changes, governance systems shift, they need to be redesigned, they need to be updated. So that once you get a governance plan, that doesn't mean you've arrived. It's always in relationship to the infrastructure that's going on within the cultural shift of the institution. To balance the legitimate interest of the authority structures, the fact that they have a legitimate interest, the president has a legitimate interest, and the board has a legitimate interest. It's the governance process that balances the legitimate interests of those three structures. Now, if you're a denominational seminar, and you have another governance group out in that yellow circle, you've got a fourth structure, then you have to balance the legitimate interests. So the governance process, as unique as it is, balances the interests of the authority structure. So faculty have as much right to change the institutional culture as the president and the board. Although it is the board that will make the final decision to balance the legitimate interest and the purpose of governance, fulfill mission with economic sustainability. It's that last phrase that a lot of groups have forgotten. To fulfill mission with economic sustainability. . 80% of our seminars today are in financial stress. And they're having to work hard at that governance purpose to get at that mission fulfilled with economic sustainability. The next category I want you to think about, and I'm just painting some broad strokes for us, is what is the relationship between the work of the institution and this participatory governance design that we call shared governance? What is the relationship between shared governance and the core work of the institution? Generally speaking, every theological school has three core work processes. You have the academic, you have the student, and you have advancement, development of resources. If you have more than this, you are too complicated to be a theological school. When I look at some organizational charts of our seminaries, looks like a chicken walked over a piece of paper with ink on the paws. They run all over the map. That's a product of the industrial age, specialization of labor, and the vertical authority. But when we define the core work of our institutions, the development of resources, development of a student community, and an educational system. Your institution will bring uniqueness to the definition of each of these core work processes. In other words, you will define what is academic. You will define what your student fears. And you will define your advancement program. And each of those is a long lecture. But you will define each of your core work processes. The next thing to take into account is the interaction horizontally between these core work processes. So that these cores are not silos. And that's what we have to avoid. They're not silos. But it's an infrastructure system that has a relationship between these three. This is why the development officer must be as important as the dean of students and the academic dean. There's a relationship between capacity to teach, finding students to teach, and having the money to teach the students. And so the coordination of the development function with the academic and student function is a critical point in designing the government system. These three core processes flow into what I have chosen to call the office of the president, which is pyramidal in shape. In other words, the word administration is one of the, abandoned functions of the cultural change of the Information Age. The office of the president is different than the function or position of president. We make a distinction between the position of president and the office of the president. I'm trying to give you secrets to an effective governance system. And the office of the president is the facilitator of the shared governance model that you're looking at. Now, one of the critical pieces of the new direction is a group that I have strictly called Strategic Planning Council. You could call anything you want, the Futures Council, Trustee Faculty Council, whatever you want to call it. It is that level within the office of the president that is planning the future of the institution, planning its educational response to change, and is, in a sense, the heartbeat of forming the institutional culture. And that is the group that is chaired by the president. If, when you're called to be president of an institution, insists upon the right to have such a group. To have five trustees, five faculty members, and five staff or administrative members on a council that you chair to do the planning, the changing, and the directing. You do not decide the outcome. You do the heavy lifting. In the council, you may decide on a particular course of action that the academic affairs or work process should fulfill. You guide that work. So you are delegating work out of that council. You're not making final decisions. The president may have a leadership team and a management team and so on. The office of the president, of course, then reports to the position of president. The president, then, is the facilitator of the governance model. The facilitator. This is not the autocratic position of the industrial age bureaucracy. This is more like an orchestra conductor. The president, as educator in the institution, is guiding and facilitating the decision-making process so that the authority structures can address those recommendations. And if it's academic in nature, the president then will refer it to the faculty. If it's business or management, operational, financial, he will refer it to the Board of Trustees. There is back and forth. There is interaction. There is movement between the authority structures and the governance process. The president's role is to facilitate that process. Four advantages. First of all, this is a system that shares authority. It shares authority. Part of the reason seminaries fail is because certain members within the institution do not assume ownership for the institution. It's just a job. This is the point where they work. There's no ownership of the institution. And so consequently, they fail. So there's shared authority. Second, there's shared leadership. Shared leadership. Wish I had time to talk about leadership, because that's one of my sore points. There's more books written on leadership than any other topic I know of, and yet we cannot define it. But let's just to say, it's the courage to act. It's the courage to act. It's shared leadership. The faculty are as much responsible for the leadership of the institution as the trustee and the president. When you look at horizontal empowerment, leadership is shared. Third, it's an information system. It's an information system. Some presidents get befuddled with the question, who do we send this information to? We should not have to ask that question. This is the roadmap for how information flows within the institution. It's a shared information system. And the fourth value, it's a self-correcting system. It's a self-correcting decision. When the board makes a mistake, the faculty has the authority to identify that mistake. And the system allows the board to correct the mistake. Likewise, when the faculty make a mistake in the educational program, the board can help them to recognize that and correct the mistake. And likewise, when the president makes a mistake. There's no matter of saving face or blaming someone. It's a self-correcting decision. Shared authority, shared leadership, information system, and a self-correcting system. All right, let me just pause right there. What questions, what interactions, what should we talk about? What do we need? This is all at work in your schools, isn't it?
One of the philosophers of science, Thomas Kuhn, talks about two kinds of science. You have that which is revolutionary or paradigm shift, and then normal science, which are just walking along. And I think yours is a good representation of a healthy rock along sort of school. But you know, many schools, evangelical schools, all of them, I guess, unless they're attended, will become more and more secular. I mean, no school wakes up one day and says, "How do we become Bob Jones? What were we thinking?" You know, it goes the other direction. And in our own Southern Baptist experience, there comes a time for a revolution where you say, we've got professors denying miracles and this and this and this. And it's like, we've got it. And at that point, if you have shared governance too heavily writ, then the faculty will trump the president at every turn. They have been around and set the new course. So I think there's a place for a president to be more autocratic, industrial, what have you, and just appoint distinguished professors or, you know, whatever to change it in a radical way. And I think in our case, Dr. Moeller had to do it, and he did it. So I would, and I will say, too, I think the accreditors make it tough to do that because they said, yeah, but have you checked with all the people or somebody? If you check with all the people, game up, you know. So I would just put that caveat in there. Otherwise, I think you could just lose the institution, and there is a time for revolution.
You're at Southern Seminary?
Southern, yeah.
I handled the 10 board meetings of Southeastern Seminary when you were going through that same issue. And I handled 2 there at Southern Seminary before Moeller came on as president.
Handled what, you spoke to them or you ran them or what?
I worked with them on their governance system vis-a-vis the accrediting standards for governance. Because, as you know, they were out of kilter on that point. And second, they lacked a platform to reach a point of not only reconciliation, but of understanding between the faculty and the board, simply because some people had gone to sleep at the switch, and appointments were made, and faculties were added, going in different direction. At Southeastern, we finally reached the point where I had to say to the faculty, you have an ethical and professional responsibility. either you say to the board, you're going to work with them, or you leave this institution. That was when they had the big exodus. You see what I mean? And that's the kind of revolution I think you're kind of speaking to. But let's hope our schools don't get to that level. Let's get active and effective before that level. That's why I appeal for faculty, presidents, and boards working together in designing the future of the institution. That means who's going to teach, what kind of students we're going to have, what are our educational standards, and so on. And it's a joint ownership process. That's what was missing in the point you referred. Yes?
I think your model does hold the opportunity for necessary revolution because of the final authority being in the Board of Trustees.
Right.
And historically, within the Southern Baptist Convention, that's how it worked out, was through the changes in the Board of Trustees. So the model does work for revolution.
Of course, I mean, with the denomination,
but could we agree that the model allows for the self-correcting action to be a revolution? And I think that model will allow for that. Because on the other hand, you can have a crisis. Crises are internal. Revolutions are external. So I think you have more of a crisis internally. Although, no, I guess I have to back up.
The denomination was external to the seminary, so it was a revolution.
Yeah, it was a revolution, yeah. Revolution and crises and process. And we're appealing for priceless as the normal way to move into the future.
One of the things I think that's interesting in this model, we've been talking about governance and authority, I think responsibility. Who bears the responsibility of the actions taken needs to be considered in this part. Now, this is just a case in point, but in my tradition, the denominational tradition, our Board of Trustees are elected every 4 years, and therefore, every 4 years, we can have, and we, matter of fact, we just had over 65% turnover of Board of Trustees. Now, that raises questions of information, to say the least, but it also raises deeper questions of responsibility as a result of that. When the final authority may not even be around long enough to see its implementation, where does that leave the institution becomes a paradigmic question, I think, and thinking about revolutionary change or regulatory change. Because even this model assumes a certain amount of stability across all three. That may or may not always be the case, particularly in light of the changes you've already
seen. Yes, and in the issue that you point out, a very real issue, this model recommends three-year terms for trustees, or 9-year terms, with only a replacement of one class at a time over the 3-year period. That way you ensure the continuity that you're looking for instead of an exodus in the event. When it comes to authority, this model assumes a clearly defined authority structure. You can't play football without sidelines and 10-yard markers. The space in which the football game exercises itself is clearly defined formally with lines. Some of you are ahead of me. You now know that this model does not support representational authority. It does not accept faculty representatives on the board, nor trustee representatives on the faculty. Representational government does not work. Governance works best when the authority structures are clearly defined and the authority assigned to the structure can function within discipline lines. It's when an authority crosses out of those lines that a referee needs to call for a penalty. That's when they're out of bounds. And believe me, we have a lot of stories about that.
I'm curious, how, in your experience, how commonly applied is this model? How rare, how, because, you know, as I think of institutions that, that I've been part of, very few seem to fit this model exactly. Are there many examples of theological institutions that you would see following this?
There are accumulating institutions moving in this direction. What I'm trying to get is a model for the future. How do we change our institutional culture? You don't call an autocratic president in to do that. But instead, you use the shared governance model. It's a slow process, but it's a sure process.
Does it have to change from any particular point? Must the trustees change it? I would expect that would have to change.
That is the most important point on this matter. That is the heart of shared governance and institutional change. If that does not function, I would not give an institution any hope for surviving with the culture that's coming. It's in that group is where the best interests that are unique to that institution are framed. And then they are blessed through the authority structure and through that process. This works best in the Protestant mainline seminaries. They have a better attitude or culture towards disciplined judicatory systems. This does not work in a Roman Catholic setting. It has a hard time in the evangelical setting. As Dan will tell you, it's very entrepreneurial. We got every model in the world in the evangelical designs of governance. But more and more, they're starting to move in this direction for survival. Yes?
You know, I feel like this is a very neat-looking, beautiful bureaucracy, and I see where you're going, and I sort of like it. But in my way of thinking about organizations, I would say what's critical is to have the mission right, and the mission is the boss. The mission is what we're serving, and not it's not up to the president, ultimately, and these other bureaucrats to decide where we're going. It's like the Titanic that could hit an iceberg, you know, beautiful boat, but where is it going? So I think it's critical to have a mission-driven, purpose-driven organization, and to have the right kind of purpose. It's got to be biblically founded, you know, et cetera. I'd like to hear you talk about where does that add the dynamism to this otherwise bureaucratic structure?
Yeah, you remember I said the purpose of government is mission fulfillment with economic sustainability. Now, whatever system we design, the outcome must be fulfilled mission with economic sustainability.
But if you read like Max Dupree and people like that, they would all say, my most important job is to maintain the mission and core values, tell the story of the organization, things like that.
That is very, very true. Remember, in times of paradigm change, culture can trump mission.
Well, many organizations have what I call an accidental mission. The characteristics are random, they're out of alignment with the mission. So we need to have an intentional mission where the core values are chosen and embedded in all levels of the culture by asking what are the values that will get us into the end zone with our mission.
Let me give you the secret. I don't want to delay much longer, but I want to give you the secret. You make a distinction between mission and vision. Those are two different phenomena. The mission is diachronic over time. An effective shared governance system. But a shared governance system that has a planning council in the office of the president at its very heart is constantly looking at that mission So if the demography within the student body begins to shift, and I start having multicultural units beginning to appear, and my admission statement is favorable to an Anglo-European history, it's time to, what? Update the mission statement. That's the group that starts the process. The vision statement is the statement that operationalizes the mission statement. This says this institution is going to fulfill its mission in this way. And that's the value of the council again. It helps the president, the board, and the faculty to decide what the vision of the institution is. But it's done on a framework of shared governance. So mission and vision is at the heart of the work of the council and of shared governance. The schools that pay no attention to mission and its interface with culture are the ones that the foundation of the schools are shifting. And we have some many examples of that. Yep.
Could you just distinguish a little more between the leadership and the management? You've got them in different teams here. What do you mean a bit more by that?
Yeah. This model accommodates a larger institution of 300 students or above. Usually in those schools, the president may have what they call the president's cabinet, or the president's council, or the president's leadership. And they represent the leaders of the four work process. So that in this institutional model, there would be four members of the president's leadership team, three vice presidents and the president. They establish the operational management policy of the institution. That same school will have a management team in which the heads of these departments, along with the leadership team, will make up the management team. And they will regulate the implementation of policies formed by the leadership team. So it's assuming a certain numerical community that can accommodate this. Now, variations of that for smaller institutions, but the same principles at work. Does that help? Okay.
Can I offer a thought on the? I just want to offer this thought and see what you think of it. I was thinking about David's question about the mission focus.
Yeah.
It seems to me the horizontal lines on this diagram are what drive a mission focus. That if the horizontal lines are weak or non-existent in an institution, the institution will lose its commitment to its mission. People will sink down into their daily tasks. But when the horizontal interactions are strong and frequent, people will be forced to ask, what is our mission? And that brings me back to your statement earlier. The faculty have as much right to speak to the culture of the institution as anyone else. And the way I see it is the faculty being active in pursuing those horizontal lines, essentially interacting along those horizontal lines, is a way of keeping the institution mission focused.
Good.
And the same would go for the other pillars as well.
Right. Thanks, Greg. That underscores the infrastructure of the institution and its purpose and mission. Give me a minute, sorry.
Will do.
I'm conscious of time.
There it is.
The third point that I want to make, the first is there's a difference between authority and governance. Second, one must identify the relationship between the institutional core work processes and the shared governance design. And third, one must understand the governance zones and their foundation. That's the last point that I want to look at. And you'd expect an archaeologist to have a credit on the exam. Institutional governance resides upon the foundational level of reality. One cannot address cultural change within the institution without understanding reality. And one of the most important positions in an institution is the institutional research person. If institutions do not have such a function or skill being operated, you can be pretty sure that's the cause of their stress. Bob Kern would love that statement. Some of my Kern Foundation friends would chuckle because they know what I'm referring to. Because shared governance is a data-driven model. And it's the institutional research level. Right, Fred? Remember 10 years ago when we sat in Bob's living room and worked on that? Institutional research. So if you're really interested in changing your institutional culture, make sure that function is represented somehow. Some person is responsible for the quantitative gathering of information that will inform the shared governance decision-making process so that faculty and trustees are not making decisions from their gut. Auditors will tell you most institutions get into financial stress is because they're not data-driven. And the downside of mission-driven is not to add the phrase with economic sustainability. So at the very bottom and foundational is institutional research. And this yields a database. It yields what's called a dashboard. It's the basis of your information system. Your information system within your institution tells me a whole lot about your institutional culture if it is based upon an understanding of reality. So the lower strata institutional research, second, relationships. It is most important for an institution to define its constituency. Its publics. Its stakeholders. If I go into a stressed institution's board meeting, then that board will say that our constituency will not allow us to do that. And it happens to be a freestanding institution, you know exactly what the problem is. They have created constituency as an excuse for not acting. Constituency definition is absolutely foundational to good, effective, efficient decision making. Public definition, stakeholder definition. Should students have a role in the emerging governance environment? That's one of the new questions that's really being debated today. Should donors have a role? Some schools have actually put positions for their donors on the internal decision-making mechanisms because they're discovering that when persons or families of wealth have a relationship to decision-making, the gifts tend to get larger and larger and larger. I can give you some examples of that. Some of you are laughing, but you know what I'm thinking about. So there's a relationship between these categories and effective government. And if you haven't taken the time to define these, and you know who these are, then you're not governing with the greatest potential. Time. It takes time to govern. And I think this is one of the greatest stresses that we face in the time of paradigm culture change. Because technology, for some reason, has destroyed time and geography. We're having to learn new rules and new practices. We are learning how to write new kinds of letters and responses. We're developing new practices. We are changing it all because of time. I average about 70 emails every day, and I've had to design a time system, time management. I would get so snowed that I would create enemies. Time. So how do we work on it? First of all, we all have to develop a rapid response mechanism. Often I will get an email with two or three lengthy questions requiring a dissertation in response. Have you ever received those? Yeah. Well, the first thing you do is quickly acknowledge the receipt of it and tell that person when you get a free moment, you'll think it through and get back to them. They deserve that kind of a rapid response. Now, 7 days later, as you have thought about, you may be able to send a 300-word response. But rapid response is critical in the age of information. So we have to personally develop these. The same for institutions. I really get aggravated at development offices that are so late in their thank you letters that a new taxable year has come along in the process. When a donor gives you $5 million, they should get a phone call from the president immediately. If a donor gives you $500, they should get an immediate phone call from the president of expression, of appreciation. We need to use our electronic tools on a rapid response to do our work. Strategic planning is a mechanism to order time. We establish goals, we establish processes to those goals, and a timeline to fulfill those processes, and then we start the implementation. Strategic planning used to be an occasional function. No effective school in the 21st century can thrive without strategic planning. It's a constant. A rolling system of strategic planning is at the very heart of the Office of the President. You saw that in the Council. We have to look at human capacity. Does our institution, and what is it, Jim Collins says, having the right people on the bus? We've heard that phrase many times. Do we have the human capacity with motivation, participation, and community? No board, faculty, or president should ever begin to change institutional culture without an assessment of its human capacity to lead change. Motivation is extremely important. Participation, ownership of the whole community. What's the nature of our learning environment? What's our intellectual capacity and expertise? Do we have in-house expertise to guide us in our shifts on globalizing the curriculum or managing a global student body? Do we have that expertise, or do we need to bring in a consultant? Don't be afraid to admit that you lack institutional expertise in any area. I assure you there are consultants by the dozen available waiting to help you. Institutional ethos. This is the intangible. When you walk on your campus or walk into your school building, do I feel your culture? Do I understand your ethos as an institution? Do I have a fullest appreciation of your heritage? What's the nature of the spiritual climate? These are all the observable attributes of institutional culture. Reality is foundational. But ethos is the observable. On this foundation, stratified foundation, we have our governance zones. The decision-making environment of the institution resides upon that foundation. And let me define the four zones for you. We have the authority structures, which basically they have as their outcome, policy and plan. When you stop to look at the board and the faculty and so on, educational policy or planning for future curriculum and so on, that's really the role of the faculty. The board may be working on operational policies, finance policies, capital policies, and planning. But that is a leadership-driven government zone made up of the shared governance phenomena that we have just talked about. So shared governance becomes one of the governance zones of the institution. But again, I want to remind you, we come back to the fundamental purpose of mission fulfilled with economic vitality. The educational system is a governance zone. We talk about it as faculty governance. Faculty governance is different than institutional governance, as every dean will tell you here. In fact, I should tell you that the dean's position is the worst position in a theological zone. Because you are sitting in a swivel chair. Some of you are swiveling right now. Because on one hand, you turn toward the faculty. And the next thing you know, you're turning toward the president. And sometimes someone spins the chair. You're not sure who you're facing. But the dean is responsible for that executive, that educational system, whatever that system might be in your institution. If I have time, I may show you a few of those. The third zone is the development zone. Well, let me turn to the student zone. The enrollment management zone, which is student-centered. Its outcome is student service. Let me give you a little catchphrase. The more you serve, the more you sell. Your institutions. The more you serve the student, the more your enrollment is going to increase. I've seen it work over and over and over. Development, resource development, gift center, the five traditional areas producing resources. These four zones, whether your school is 100, 1,000, or 4,000, you're all alike. This is the model that makes all of you common. You have four government zones in your institution. If you have more, you have made your world too complex to change. I'm just going to buzz through these. I talked about them. This is an enrollment model. Those of you that are interested in increasing students, this is a model that you need to pay attention to. All the way from the analytical student database, that's the reality of your student potentials, moving it up into your institutional strategic planning process, how they fit into that plan, and then the evaluation, that's the core of it. The function of the governance zones of enrollment management, a lot on both sides, the enrolled student and the quality prospect. So it's simply a model to develop an effective enrollment system. This is a model for an effective educational system. Nowadays, it has three components to it, and it probably will have more as innovation is underway. You will have the traditional classroom for a bit. You will have video conferencing or electronic distributions, however you want to put it, and you'll have distance learning. But the fact they are the influential ones in all of these models. And I think the only point I want to make with this diagram is it is driven by the fact. This is the financial model for our institution of the future, in which it works for an equilibrium between operations, endowment, and facilities. I won't say much more than that. A lot could be said in order to gain sufficient financial resources. Here's what I want you to really see. The faculty is responsible for 80% of the revenue. Let me say it again. The faculty are responsible for 80% of the revenue. If an institution is short on revenue, you start by examining faculty governance and what is the role of the faculty in creating revenue. 20% is the responsibility of leadership and development. And if your economic model does not come close to this, then either you have a rich uncle, a deep endowment, or an overexercised donor base. But I can guarantee you, after examining 256 seminars, this generalized economic model comes very close to picturing reality. 80% revenue developed by the faculty. And if you were finance officers, we'd talk about net tuition. The faculty is responsible for net tuition. Three questions as we wrap up this kind of discussion. Do I think theological schools have the right authority structures and the right people or positions to run a new model of theological education? Are we accepting without reflection what tradition offers us as far as institutional structures go? Or do we need a revolution? Or do we need a crisis? Do we have that? Second, how important are accreditation standards in times of new realities, new practices, and new experience? And third, how will a changed undergraduate education change theological schools and their admission requirements? Okay, who wants to tackle any of this? Yes, Charlie.
Dr. Cooley, how flexible is ATS becoming in light of all of the crises in seminaries? Is there, do you see in the next 5 years more flexibility?
Do we have any ATS members here? Any officers, any staff participants? How do you keep so isolated?
We control the invite list for the retreat.
Part of the difficulties and challenges our schools have confronted is the opportunity to experiment. And particularly in the academic area, faculty should be granted anywhere from 3 to 5 years to experiment with new programs before the board has to exercise final authority to approve or not to approve. But do our ATS standards allow for that experimentation? And so I've argued with them. And so they have introduced a quasi-step. If you want to experiment with a bachelor's degree in piano tuning, you can submit your request to the commission, and they will grant you a period of experimentation, but you must report. So yes, there's a flexibility coming. Furthermore, they have just received a $5 million grant from the Liberty Development to study precisely the relationship between changing culture and new demands on the educational system and their impact upon accreditation standards. So at the next biennium, we are to begin to give reports on how culture change, experimentation, and accreditation standards in the final discourse will emerge. So on behalf of the ATS, yes, they are becoming flexible and they are starting to recognize the need that standards can be so rigid that an institution cannot accommodate culture change. That's an important observation. Yes?
Can I respond just a little bit? I oversee accreditation. And we're in the 10-year cycle of both our regional accreditor and TASC. In fact, the day before I came here, we mailed the TASC, the Association of Theological Schools. They are a little slower than our regional accreditor, but they're catching up. I've changed my attitude toward our regional accreditor. I used to view them as bureaucrats who were in my way, a quasi-governmental structure that impeded our creativity. I now view them as an organization that protects me from the federal government. And I mean that seriously. The accrediting bodies, I think, at least the regionals are, and I think the association is too, are recognizing they really can be our advocates, and their future is in there too. So I've come to not view them nearly as negatively as I did 5 years ago.
Good. Rick?
But the irony is, I think that's right. As a chief academic officer answering to these two accrediting bodies, there is an emphasis on experimentation and innovation, a willingness, but there's an enormous regulatory burden that falls upon smaller institutions like all of us to make the case. Now, excuse me, it's always a good thing to have to make the case, but it gets tiresome in terms of institutional resources constantly to have to fulfill that task. And so any counsel or wisdom as we talk about accreditation standards, also this what feels like a higher level of hierarchy of rank. regulatory burdens that fall on smaller institutions. We're flattening out authority early morning, you were saying. It feels like, to most of us institutionally, that the external regulatory bodies are getting larger and larger. Am I assessing that situation right?
Right. It's not just an ATS problem. It's a larger cultural phenomenon in the six regional schools. And it's also a problem in the DOE in Washington. So to me, it is a sign of a cultural paradigm shift. The demand for new rules and new practices, or put it another way, a demand for new standards. What is going to represent the standard for theological education in the 21st century? And I think that's the purpose of the Lilly Endowment Grant. And I think that's one of the points, if I remember it in the proposal, is to adjust to that.
First question about the right, not just drugs to the right people, this is to run the new office.
Right.
Many of the academic events, the people I find in leadership come from academia, which is a very conservative approach to things, very incremental.
Right.
How do you get some of the entrepreneurial impetus from those who hold the authority to make the kind of changes that are going to bring about these new models or even entertain that there are new models?
Right. There are some institutions that are looking at different authority structures, even though broadly, there are faculty and trustees, but they're looking at new empowerment groups. For example, the Strategic Planning Council in some schools, right above it, will have a governing council. And then any recommendations going to the governing council has the imprimatur of the faculty and the board of it. So they've cut down the long delay that often takes between faculty and boards. So a new kind of authority understanding, but a new structure is being put in place. That is one response to that. The other response is to change new types of persons in what we would call the management side. For example, I just talked to Vice President of Strategic Digital Education. How many of you have that position in your school? And that person is in the office of the president. Because that person influences the whole work capability of the institution. And therefore cannot work up through some kind of process. They need to work with the president. So maybe we need new positions. I know a couple of schools that are eliminating deans of students. The whole concept of the evacuation of the resident campus as it evaporates are creating new understanding of student communities. And when you move into self-help environments, you don't really need a dean of students. Maybe that position and salary could be put over into the educational system. So new positions are coming into play. Just as the industrial age defined new functions, the information age is defining new functions. But we can't go on just layering them on top, making an accretion of positions. We have to work into the replacement part. And this is where you elevate the anxiety in institutional cultural change. I can handle anxiety. I can't handle resistance. Think about it. We can handle the anxiety, but we can't handle the resistance.
I have a question. The schools that seem to be on the cutting edge of this, at least in some of the Christian models are the for-profit schools, and there's a few of them. And being somewhat familiar with that model, it seems your model is like the Platonic perfect form, when what's happening in reality is not that.
Right.
The professors are now content deliverers,
right.
And what they deliver are created by committees of content specialists, and they get metric forms every 2 weeks, and they respond. And then so the professors are 9-to-5 cube commodities. And I'm wondering.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you brought it up because I don't want to go that direction.
But I wanted
to. What I want to hold on to is our sense of community. Now, we're going to have to redefine it. That's what we're trying to do. But I don't want to really lose community. I don't want to lose face to face, even though I am also going to have content provided through electronic means and self-help for student services. But I still got to find a way for community. That's our job. That's what we're called to do now.
So it's something, I guess then, something fundamentally different, because by definition, isn't college, collegium, but it's a face-to-face, it's you and I,
right.
In community, to use your term.
Right.
But there's something, obviously, by definition, fundamentally different.
Right. Very
that's
different.
Happened. Or
that's happened. But I happen to work with the word seminar, which means seedling. And a seed has to have some soil to grow it. And I don't want to give up my community and discipleship and formation, even though I have to find new mechanisms. I don't want to go the direction of the for-profit. I want to find new mechanisms. I would rather struggle through shared governance and working hard to design new systems. I don't want to give up on community. That may be a bias, but that's what I was pushing for.
I like it. I just think it almost seems as it's impossible.
Yeah. Right.
I know that, you know, on, not just in theological education, but elsewhere, you know, the last 20, 30 years have seen a growth in the number of administrators in schools, and the growth of the power of administration, the lessening of faculty power, and so on, and the sort of outsourcing of faculty roles to adjunct professors, and so on. But also, so a lot of people think we're in a kind of higher educational bubble anyway because of the cost, the rampant growth of the cost of higher education, of which we are a part. I wonder whether we, you know, there may be ways of thinking about a different outsourcing so that perhaps what we need, as some people have said, is adjunct administrators. And or really, in other words, is there a way to refocus the institutions that we represent on the core tasks and to, you know, find creative ways to outsource those things which are more mechanical, because we perhaps recognize just what you said, the teaching role or the, you know, the theological training role that we really believe in, you know, is not just information gathering, isn't just self-help, you know, but actually requires community, relationship, spirit, heart, and all the rest of it. Anyway, what if you had any response?
Well, if I would set up an outsourcing operations service to handle your accounting, purchasing, personnel, and so on, and have 10 institutions would buy my service to eliminate all of their operational costs and so on. Would you be willing to buy that off?
I think I think almost any institution would be willing if they figure it would help the bottom line and still maintain adequate, you know, standards of personnel and character and so on that we want within that community.
Let's go further. Supposing your institution spends 40% of its revenue on operations. Well, by outsourcing it to me, I can do it for 20%.
Right.
You would become a customer. Okay. Well, we're headed in that direction. you're going to see new centralized administrative services in what we call backroom operations. And schools will be back to the 18th and 19th century. As Mark Twain said, what? One person on the end of the log and a student on the other end. And that's going to be theological education. In other words, operational costs, be they capital, personnel, or function, are going to start to be eliminated or centralized, since we all have a common need for those services. It's 2:31, Greg, you're taking a minute.
That's all right. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate that. Everyone, if I could...